the memories of 25 years ago are buried deep, but when they come out, it's sort of like some of those rocky shores. All the stink is still there. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Well, I'm asking you to give your thoughts 25 years after the Exxon Valdez environmental catastrophe. You can call toll-free at 1-800-478-8255. Statewide and toll-free, a local call on Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. I have an expert panel, and I'm hoping for a meaningful conversation about something many of us have thought about a lot on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by First National Bank Alaska, earning Alaska's trust for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. If you're interested in serving on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council, the deadline to apply is Friday, March 21st. Call 1-800-478-1456 for more information. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the trail. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
In a way, it still seems like it was only yesterday to me, but when I think back on it, I had only been at the Alaska Public Radio Network for 5 years when this happened. And I ended up going right to the Exxon Valdez spill from Anchorage, finding a plane the second day into it, and flying in with Pat Lynn, who was running the newspaper in Valdez, and getting back into town. Eric Gundlach was on that plane. He was the consultant who was providing, he had worked the Amoco Cadiz spill, and he provided the software to the state for entering the tracking data that would come in from the airplanes every day so they could keep track of, you know, sort of an early form of GIS, basically. So those were some of the people that were on the plane. I landed in Valdez, and we flew over the thing on the way, so I got some idea of what was going on. I looked down there, and there seemed like, along with the boat, there were like a couple of toothpicks. And they told me, no, those are the booms. I mean, it was like nothing. It was like nothing. And I was not very far into the story before I realized that this is a story, the biggest story of my career. This is a situation so huge, it could eat me alive. And sooner or later, I was just going to exhaust myself on this thing. And would I have made any difference? And I did. And, you know, after about 5 days, Peter Kenyon came in and took over the shift. Bob King was there helping out. And Danny Swerdling and Ira Glass of NPR came in. But that was a little bit of a disappointment to me because they also had to limit their efforts if they were going to get anything done. So they deliberately kept it very restricted. Claire Richardson was a big asset there in getting coverage out. But with it, everybody wanted coverage. We could work all as much as we want and do as many stories as we wanted, and everybody wanted everything that we could possibly do on it. It was like the thing was enormous. It was huge. So that's kind of my memory. And someplace in there, amidst all the anger, I also, and the tears, because there were tears all the time, I realized, you know, that I felt that I was partly responsible. How could I have not known that the oil industry was being allowed to send out bigger loads of crude oil on those waters there, those beautiful waters of Prince William Sound? They were being allowed to ship more than they could clean up. Somehow that had escaped my notice that the regulators would allow such a thing, but they had. And so I felt I should have been reporting on that all along, and why I hadn't really. So that's kind of my story, but I want your stories too. And what I'd like us to concentrate on, and what I've asked the panelists to look at, and I think we have some great expert panelists, I know we do, is 25 years after Exxon Valdez, what would effective regulation look like? Because I feel that many of our efforts, we really thought we'd learned our lesson back then, and then somehow 21 years goes by and Deepwater Horizon, which is even worse, occurs. And when you look at it, you say, well, it was a lot of the same factors. There was fatigue. There were bosses that were demanding too much. There was cost cutting. And then there was even more secrecy, really, surrounding the Deepwater Horizon than there was surrounding the Exxon Valdez, where nobody quite knew how to keep things secret yet, so it was always leaking out. But now that was corrected. And there were efforts afterwards. Oil Pollution Act of 1990 comes to mind, of course. But in the state government, as we'll hear, there were efforts to set up the state's own, beef up the state's own response capabilities, its own prevention, its own oversight capabilities. And pretty soon they were eroded away. There was, we would say, slippage. So what does it really take then? What does it really take to have effective regulation that really works and keeps this slippage from happening? That's the question. So with me on the other side of the desk is Lois Epstein. Lois is currently with the Wilderness Society, which opposes Arctic drilling, Arctic offshore drilling, adamantly. But Lois also has a long engineering background. And where were you when the Exxon Valdez happened, Lois?
I was in Washington, D.C. I was working for Environmental Defense Fund as an engineer. And I remember when we were asked by the New York Times to have a reaction to what happened in Alaska, my strongest feeling was we need to move away from oil. We need to move towards renewables. And sadly, we haven't made all that much progress since then in that direction. We still are very much reliant on oil.
Yeah, and it's getting to be different oils, too. I mean, now there's oil that's moving in rail cars, for better or for worse. And rail cars, that's vulnerable. We've had rail car episodes in Alaska. And there's tar sands oils that are, seem to me to be a lot more toxic and take a lot more out of the environment to produce, as I understand it. You got to burn a lot of natural gas just to cook that stuff. So the old BTU thing and the carbon equation on is all out of whack. We seem to be going backwards here, Lois.
Well, and the thing to remember is that you can have spills and safety problems at each point in the oil production, transportation, use process. And so that means you have pipeline issues that have to be addressed and regulated and overseen. And you have rail car issues becoming a very big issue as we have shale oil being transported in the lower 48. You have refineries, which every few years you have a tragedy there. This is a dangerous, dirty material that we're dealing with. It's not homogeneous, so even the best engineers can't always predict what it's going to do. We don't understand and have all the tools we need to figure out what's going on underground. So we have pressure issues that can cause problems. Repsol several years ago had a blowout on the North Slope that went on for a very long time because of the Arctic conditions. It couldn't really be clamped down for until it got a little warmer. And so the best way to prevent tragedies in places like the Arctic Ocean is to not go out there and drill when we have the brain power, we have the technology to move away from oil. We can do it faster than we're doing, certainly.
Yeah, you sent out a very nice little one-pager to me, and one of the things you point out is that what we need is a little bit more respect for nature.
Yeah, the industry, in particular, someone who's been dealing with them for over 20 years, has a lot of hubris. You know, they like to do things that are challenging, and if things go wrong, they figure they have the technology and the money to address them. Well, from a public standpoint, you know, that's not good enough. We want to see there not be accidents. We don't want to see fisheries harmed. We don't want to see the North Slope contaminated and harming subsistence. It's it's really important that it's almost a clash of values that we're talking about. And when you have a powerful industry, the voices of people that feel differently and know we can make different choices aren't always heard.
Well, now, okay, you're a voice, you're working for an NGO, but you also serve, you're on the advisory committee of the BSEE. How's that going?
Well, that's the Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement.
It used to be part of the Minerals Management
Service.
That's
right. Yeah. That's right. And the advisory committee and our other guest, Marilyn, was also part of that, has looked at what kinds of changes need to be made. It was a multi-stakeholder group, so we were working within some constraints, you know, that everybody had to agree to it. One important thing for an Alaska audience is that we did all agree that there need to be Arctic-specific standards before drilling offshore in the Arctic Ocean. Now, I'm saying that as someone that thinks we need standards, we also need better cleanup technologies. There's been very few advances in the 25 years since the Exxon Valdez situation, and even then, you know, there wasn't very much, and so a little bit more is not very much. So that's just one piece of the puzzle having to do with the Arctic Ocean, but you know, certainly Arctic specific standards that address the ice conditions, that address the areas that need to be looked at and protected differently, those are all important things that need to be put in place before we'd even consider moving forward with Arctic Ocean drilling.
Well, I'm pretty sure before anybody tows a rig across the Gulf of Alaska again, they're gonna invest in a little better winch technology.
Well, you know, someone made the decision that the Kulik, the Shell drill rig, should be moved in December, and when we all know the conditions are just terrible. Maybe you can get a better winch, but you know, it was to Shell, that was the right time to do it, and you know, they had you know, Mother Nature won essentially.
I think the marine casualty investigation of that was quite thorough. And, you know, I really look forward to that report. I hope that people actually look at it. I think it contains a lot of lessons for all of us as to how things can go wrong.
That's right.
Because they sure can.
I'm a big believer in independent investigations. And, you know, you have the Coast Guard and the Department of Interior investigating itself. So that's not entirely ideal. It's different than when you have the
NTSB was
NTSB investigating plane crashes because they don't have an interest. But, you know, we have to keep in mind that after Deepwater Horizon in Mexico, Congress did not act in a way that, you know, addressed what some of those problems were, different than the Oil Pollution Act of 1990, which was a law that actually has had some positive impact in reducing tanker and barge spills greatly since then. But in terms of giving me as an engineer confidence that we're not going to have offshore drilling incidents, we don't have any changes in the law. It's an old law, the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act. And that's unfortunate. You know, it's very tough to do increased regulation in this political environment, both at the state and the federal level.
Willie and Talkeetna, I'm going to go to your call in a second, but I want to introduce our second guest, who is Marilyn Hyman. And Marilyn is now director of the U.S. Arctic Program of the Pew Charitable Trusts. She joins us from radio station, the studios of radio station KPLU in Seattle by digital link. Marilyn, welcome to Talk of Alaska. Where were you when the Exxon Valdez hit Bly Reef?
Well, I was working for the Alaska State Legislature at the time. I was working for the House Resources Committee. And I remember very clearly after the first couple days of the big storm, then there was flat, calm water for like 2 weeks. And every day, either Denny Kelso, who was the commissioner of DEC at the time, or Amy Kyle, the deputy, would come in to the committee room, and we'd say, what's happening? Is there any spill equipment on the water? Is there any response happening? And they'd say, no, there's no equipment. We still don't have anything in the way of response, you know, mechanical response on the water. And this went on day after day after day. And it was quite unsettling for everyone in the Alaska legislature. And I do remember it was a really different time because everyone, Republican, Democrat, all the members of the legislature wanted to make sure we did the right thing, that we figured out how to make sure that this never happened again, because so many people were negatively affected by the oil spill, and so much of Prince William Sound and the spill area out to Kodiak and beyond was really damaged. So it was a very scary time. As you said, there were a lot of tears. But you ask, you know, what do we need to have in place? What always comes to mind for me is the need for vigilance, that you have to have people paying attention, people like Lois, people like myself. But one of the most important things that came out of the Exxon Valdez oil spill were the regional citizens advisory councils. And I noticed there was an ad right before this if you want to apply to be on one. And I can't say enough about the importance of a group like that to ensure that complacency doesn't set in, because that is what I've seen in my career over and over. After a spill, all of a sudden, everybody pays very close attention, or after some sort of accident, and then over time, complacency sets in. But if you have some systems in place, like a citizens' council, or you ensure that the government agencies who are responsible for overseeing have adequate resources to do their job, it makes a huge difference. So that was kind of my experience. And after I worked for the legislature the following summer, because we had 120-day sessions back then, I worked for the Oil Spill Commission, the State Oil Spill Commission, that recommended many of the legislative changes that we can talk about.
Yeah.
This
RCAC, I think it's important historically to point out that there was already a move in place to create something because of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline before the spill. And when OPA-90 came in, it just sort of cemented in place something that had been building up with Stan Stevens and them beforehand. And so we got a very strong body, really a stronger body, you could say, more of a watchdog than, say, the Cook Inlet RCAC is.
Yeah, and you made a really good point when you were saying you felt bad about, in some ways, about the Exxon Valdez, and I felt like that through my career. I didn't feel bad at the Exxon Valdez because I was very young and it was new. I was just starting to work on issues like this. But then when the spill on the North Slope happened in 2009, some 46,000 barrels of oil spilled from a feeder line to the Trans-Alaska pipeline, I was kind of like, wow, how did this happen? You know, how? And then when the Deepwater Horizon spill happened, I felt the same way, because as Lois pointed out, we passed legislation, both state and federal, following the Exxon Valdez, that dealt with tanker traffic, but we didn't deal with pipeline spills. And then at the time, we didn't deal with offshore drilling rigs. And so, you know, that we only focused on that piece and we weren't able to see that other types of oil incidents can happen, and we have to be aware and prevent those as well.
Yeah, well, I think, in fairness, I mean, and, you know, I looked pretty closely at that one. Nobody really knew that, or probably some people did know, but they were not the kind of people that anybody in the upper part of the company listened to, that it might be a good idea to pig out those transit lines, because they weren't the sort of thing, they weren't carrying anything that they thought would gunk up that bad, but it turned out they were.
Well, and the other thing is that the federal government did not regulate those lines.
Not at all.
Right.
And then one day they just suddenly stepped in and did.
Well, and that's because historically they thought they only had the resources to deal with the more important higher pressure lines.
Yes.
And after you do go in and do something about those, and it's imperfect, but something is in place, they are a regulatory framework, then all of a sudden the things that were left out become the highest priority. And you got to go back. It's an iterative process. And you can't just neglect infrastructure. And, you know, we're talking about things that corrode. And industry, there's always a tension between making money and doing the job you need to do in terms of preventing releases.
You know, Lois, what's suddenly popping into my head is Point Thompson.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, granted, we thought we'd be focusing quite a bit on offshore activity, but then you look onshore and you think, well, what's Exxon going to do up there? First, they have to they have to build more pipeline. They got ice roads, seasonal construction. There's all this gravel being moved around up there. And the idea is really to take the liquids out of the gas and produce that and move those in that pipeline. We're dealing with a lot of chemistry here, it seems like.
We are, but especially when something is new, you're going to have probably the latest. That's the right time to put in your your different higher tech ways of doing things better. So,
well, it's not easy for me to get Exxon to tell me a word about any of this.
Well, transparency is a huge issue, and that goes to why you need to have this constant vigilance. That goes to government's role.
There's no oversight body up there outside of government.
No, there isn't.
And Marilyn, you probably remember in the legislature the following year when there was a dispute about the. I remember Ramona Barnes getting on the floor of the House. I think it was a committee hearing. And saying it's just not right that the private property rights of these oil producers are being violated with unannounced inspections by state oversight personnel. I distinctly
called an inspection bill the Gestapo bill.
Yeah. I mean, this is just the very next year.
Yeah.
That's how fast a slippage will set in. Let's go to Willie. He joins the program from Talkeetna. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Willie.
Hey, thanks a lot, Steve. Just a couple of one major point I wanted to make in listening to the discussion about that pipeline rupture on the North Slope. I'm not going to use any names or anything, but I've talked to a number of truck drivers and welders and stuff, and they pretty much, the guys that were seemed to be in the field in the know, said that they were routinely ordered to go ahead and use what they knew were substandard pipes that were beyond their service life and corrosion or that had welding problems in them because, hey, it's okay, nobody's going to inspect these.
Well, so Willie, I'm so glad you brought that up. That is actually, to me, is brand-new information. I didn't know about there's places where, you know, there were trucks running back and forth over top of these lines, and they were getting beat up and distorted.
Yeah.
But I never heard that one from you. And there are many things. I read everything I can about the Exxon Valdez spill, and I realize there's things that is – pretty soon only going to be in my head. I need to write them down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's human nature. We all want to cut corners. And I think multinational corporations have to have this kind of oversight to hold their feet to the fire, or they're going to do what's right for their quarterly bottom line. They're not interested in the future, or they're not interested in the messes that we all seem to be really good in our culture and leaving for our grandkids to clean up. And, you know, in terms about the Exxon Valdez thing, my main point I wanted to make is there was, I felt, a very equitable court settlement that provided for a lot of financial remuneration to the fishermen in Prince William Sound that lost a lot of their income. And that oil is still there, by the way. It's like, clean up, what was that? You dig down in those gravels, it's still there. Anyway, it seemed like Exxon was much more interested in paying $1 billion plus to their lawyers in their legal department to go to the Supreme Court and cheat the fishermen out of the money that was rightly theirs than they were interested in making it right. And so my reaction to that, I vote with my dollars as a consumer. To this day, I will not purchase anything anywhere that says Exxon on it because I will not countenance that kind of just running over everybody's rights.
Thanks for the reminder, Willie.
You're welcome, and thank you very much for the program.
Yeah, just to briefly go over what happened with the court deal, it was a punitive damage award. Judge Holland, William Holland, was the judge in that. It went on for a long time, and it was always fought by Exxon. The jury finally came out and said, we're going to punish Exxon by depriving them of 1 year's profits. That was the basis for $5 billion verdict. That was whittled down to 10% of that by the time it was all over in the Supreme Court. And that's how that one went. Well, now, Marilyn Hyman, there was an effort by the state, was there not, to also set up a kind of an independent oversight situation?
Yeah, there was a Citizens Oversight Council that was created after the spill, one of the many bills that were passed the legislature. But it, I think it only lasted 2 or 3 years, and then it was sunsetted, and they never authorized it again.
Do you remember what kind of talk there was about that? Was it just of the nature of, you know, oh, well, these are just a bunch of soreheads and troublemakers, and they're getting in the way?
I think it was kind of like that.
Costing us jobs.
Do we really need to be digging this up? There's always been kind of this feeling. It's funny, Michelle Brown was the director of that at the time and then later became the DEC commissioner. But I do remember there's always been a little bit of a tug of war between the agencies and this, you know, like the RCACs, because the agencies, you know, need the money to oversee, you know, all of these issues. And then they say, well, look, all the money's going to these citizens advisory councils, and there's a struggle. But, you know, times change. Sometimes you have a robust program within the government like they have now, that you talked about. MMS is now Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement and Bureau of Ocean and Energy Management. And they actually do have much more money, and they're doing a much better job overseeing offshore drilling. And it's really, we've seen a lot of reform, even though we haven't had legislative response to the Deepwater Horizon spill. We do have, you know, the government has made a lot of administrative reforms. But, you know, you don't know. That may last a while. Another administration could come in. They would cut those budgets, could cut those budgets back. So you need to have, you know, these citizens' councils. And you mentioned that there was no council overseeing the pipeline. Well, after Open 90, there was a presidential task force. That Open 90 had a section on a presidential task force on the pipeline, but it was never funded, and they repealed that section. So there's always pressure in the legislative bodies to get rid of these reforms and get rid of these citizen councils.
And now that I think about it, I think the Riley Commission that Fran Ulmer was on, I think they also recommended citizens oversight, and that also went nowhere.
Well, you know, I have to, in defense of both Senator Begich and Senator Murkowski, they both looked seriously at this and were very interested in doing citizens council in the Arctic. But since no legislation passed, they were unable to get anything into any of the bills. So, or they talked about getting something in, but the bills did not pass.
We're talking with Marilyn Hyman of the Pew Charitable Trust, Lois Epstein of the Wilderness Society, and we're going over regulatory slippage after Exxon Valdez and what would be effective regulation. What would effective regulation look like? And we're doing it with two people that actually were opposed to offshore drilling in the Arctic, but they were willing to come along because they have great professional expertise and history, as you can tell, in this industry.
Actually, I think both of our positions are related
more
to the
more nuanced
fact.
Than
yes,
that?
Yes, yes. But you know, from where I sit, it's we're not ready to be doing that now. And my strong hope is that we will be less likely to do that, because we will have been smart enough and shown enough leadership in this country to have moved away from needing that. And, you know, incidentally, as we have more and more shale oil development, which is another way, another different type of geology, while that has impacts and is another example of an area that's not well regulated, and there's a big push by the industry to only have the states do that, it is producing a lot of oil in the United States. It's going to produce oil in Mexico and in other places. And in fact, so much of that might keep the price of oil down that might save the Arctic Ocean ultimately, because that's an expensive area to be operating. And, you know, not only do you have technical challenges, it's a huge, huge investment
needed.
Yeah,
but, you know, geopolitics and nature can overrun all this, because when you think about it, the future of Greenland's changing as that ice pulls back. The Russians And the Chinese now.
Except the Arctic Ocean is always going to be among the riskiest and most costly places to drill.
Yeah, but when, once
no
the
doubt.
Investment's made, I mean,
it hasn't been made yet.
Yeah.
We still have a window here to, and you know, that's something we're working on. Shell has a new head of its organization who hasn't made those decisions to buy the leases in Alaska's Arctic Ocean, and you know, we might see a different decision. I hope so.
Hmm. And meanwhile, we have Statoil out there, too, don't forget.
That's right. But they're waiting and watching
Shell and
ConocoPhillips likewise. I mean, there's a reason that they're not working all independently. They share the same pipelines. There are cost savings in doing that. So if Shell made a different decision, the dominoes would fall, I predict.
Yeah. Marilyn, before the station break, something you wanted to add?
Oh, I was going to say one of the really important things that happened after the Exxon Valdez that the Citizens Councils have, you know, continued to support is these two vessels escorting escorting every vessel that goes from Valdez to the Hinchinbrook entrance. And we were able to get, Governor Tony Knowles was able to get the requirement and work with Sir John Brown from BP to get those tankers escorted by the highest power tractor tugs in the world. And those kinds of things, they tried to eliminate that requirement over time. And yet, again, Senator Murkowski and also Senator Begich worked to make sure that that was part of a law, Coast Guard legislation, and it continues to be the law today, and I hope it continues as long as oil flows through that pipeline.
Yeah, and you know, those vessels have saved our butts a couple of times now. I know that for a fact. I mean, so they sit idle most of the time. That's just fine. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Providence Imaging Center, with its newest center in Soldotna, offering CT scans, MRI, ultrasound, and digital X-ray to residents on the Kenai Peninsula. Learn more at provimaging.com. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
It's Talk of Alaska. I will tell you frankly that I love doing history shows because it gives me a chance to dig around in that stuff yet one more time, and there's always more to be dug out, and there are few events about which that is more the case than the Exxon Valdez oil spill. There is so much to be dug around in. I think when I probe my personal reactions on this, I would say that there's so much emotion associated with my memories of the spill that I just don't bring them out very much. I don't think about them very much. So they sit there after 25 years, just come right with some of the surprising force sometimes when I remember some of the things I remember, the tears in people's eyes and the anger and all the fighting and futilities and frustrations, and you know, it can be pretty powerful. Let's go to Renee, who joins the program from Esther. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Renee.
Good morning. I was in graduate school when this flashed across the screen of the TV. I was outside, but I was an Alaska resident going to school outside. And, of course, in my internship in mental health at that time, it made me kind of a celebrity, and everybody wanted to know, what's your opinion of this? And I'd only spent limited time there. The initial impact, like with most train wrecks, was the most stunning, really, was to see the immediate impact on wildlife, on fish, etc. you know, today we have debates going on about, well, is the sludge and the gravel really causing that much trouble today? Does it need to be cleaned up? But that imagery of the initial photographs was what was most stunning, as with any crisis. To me, it's somewhat ironic that one of the members of Exxon's former legal team now heads up our state as our head administrator. You know, I mean, that you couldn't write that stuff into a science fiction novel, I don't think. But
in Alaska, we shed our political past. We get to have new lives and reincarnate politically.
Well, I regard it as political amnesia.
Something
at
like
any
that.
Rate, you know, there has been progress. We've gone to double hull tankers, but we've got a long way to go. What was touched on was, Arctic Ocean or Beaufort Sea drilling. And, you know, these guys couldn't contain Deepwater Horizon, which is in a large gulf, but nonetheless an inlet of sorts, in relatively calm water. What are they going to do in 6 foot of broken sea ice? You know, you can't boom it. Basically, you're going to wring your hands. And I distinctly recall, you know, when the terminal in Exxon went on autopilot in crisis mode with reel-to-reel tapes recording all their telephone traffic during the Exxon spill. And there was a guy down there for them in Valdez calling back up and saying, hey, you know, and the guy in Anchorage at that time said, well, have you got the skimmers out there? And the guy in Valdez responded, this was all recorded reel to reel. He said, well, the skimmers aren't working. And the guy in Anchorage said, I don't care. Get them out there. The press is present. In other words, presentation was far more important to these guys than reality and pragmatism. You know, is it working? Who cares? People are watching. So these are people who have gotten tax credits, by the way, in terms of the ruptured feeder line on the slope. They get tax credits for doing maintenance. How often are we auditing those tax credits? They're applying for, well, we should get a write-off here because we did this. How do we know they did that? So we need more audits. That's one thing we could do to make sure that we're getting what we're paying for.
You definitely answered the question. That's good. You went right to the question, Renee. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
It's Talk of Alaska. We're talking about what would effective regulation of the oil and gas industry look like 25 years after the Exxon Valdez, four years after Deepwater Horizon as well. And we've got Marilyn Hyman of the Pew Charitable Trust, Lois Epstein of the Wilderness Society with us on this program. Fascinating conversation. Let's go to Terry, joins us program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Terry.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to say that Lois and Marilyn are personal heroes of mine, and I'm so thankful for what they're doing. But your teaser question was, what would it take to earn our trust?
Yes.
And that goes to a whole different issue, that corporations aren't set up around trust. They actually have a fiduciary duty to maximize shareholder profit the next quarter, a very close term. And they are useful tools for citizens, but they should be subservient to we the people, and they're not right now.
Well, that's very fundamental. I'm really glad that you brought that up, because one thing we haven't done here, which I really swore that I would do at some point, is to look through the lens of political science at this situation. And that's one of the reasons why the RCACs and citizen oversight are so important, because without that, you always get slippage. That's the only thing that goes against that entropy, is a disparate civic entity. And no part of institutionalized government likes to give up authority and power. And hence, even the courts don't really like citizen oversight. And certainly corporate doesn't like it. And certainly the regulators don't like it. The legislative branch doesn't like it. It's all taking power away from them. And so in political science here, there's just a different kind of equation we're looking at. And now you come in and you say, well, corporations, they have charters, they have shareholder value. We shouldn't even, trust doesn't even enter into it with them. Well, that's true. That is also part of the political science of it. So that's a great point, Terry.
Right. So it's not so much, I mean, corporations are useful tools. Like I said, they were created so that back in the days when ships were sailing from Spain to Africa, you know, if the whole thing went down, that the debt didn't transfer from one generation to the next for many generations. So it's just that it's a tool, And if something's wrong with the way it's set up, we have a responsibility in a democracy to change the laws to make that tool back in the hands of the people, which includes the government agencies. I mean, the government agencies, if they are being accountable, are acting supposedly for the people's good. But until we take away or shift the corporate personhood laws from when they were changed back in the 1880s with corrupt judges in the Robber Baron days, when those corporate lawyers finally succeeded after many attempts to get their rights written into the Constitution as if they were flesh and blood human beings. That's the core problem of the issue, because then they can also, through Citizens United now, make ridiculous amounts of campaign contributions, and that affects the ability of people like Marilyn and Lois to make regulations, because there are so many lobbyists working against that.
Terry, I sense a whole other issue that's another show.
Yeah, I think so. That would be great, Steve.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for your call. Charles Wolforth chimed in here and says, well, after Exxon Valdez, we got Open 90. After BP, Deepwater Horizon, we got nothing. Despite the recommendations of the commission that Fran Ulmer served on, does the panel feel that the political process is still a good avenue to deal with these issues? I think we're partly answering that, don't you?
Yeah, I think so. I think we need legislative change and we need regulatory change. And it was unfortunate to see that the Congress could not pass legislation. A bill did pass the House. But it never got through the Senate, and then when Congress changed after the elections, it was a non-starter, and we've seen what's been happening in Congress lately. Not many bills are passing. But I think a really important thing that I should clarify, Pew is not opposed to offshore drilling in the Arctic. What we do want to see is world-leading standards for any company that's operating in the Arctic, and that there are areas of the Arctic that are particularly, the Arctic marine ecosystem, that are particularly sensitive and important to, you know, marine mammals, subsistence hunting, the communities, and that those places should be put off limits within the Arctic for offshore drilling to ensure we don't have spills that happen right in the middle of a beluga migration or a bowhead whale migration or, you know, where walrus are, you know, or feeding or anything like that. So we've been working very hard to identify both strong regulations that can be put in place to deal with the kinds of situations like seasonal drilling restrictions, so drilling doesn't occur during ice, you know, importance of having equipment, trained personnel that can respond in those kinds of conditions. Somebody mentioned 6-foot seas. Well, during the Deepwater Horizon, they stopped all drilling. Or not all drilling, all spill response when they had 6-foot seas. Well, we know in the Arctic we can get seas quite a bit bigger than 6-foot seas. And we need to look at these kinds of conditions and figure out what regulatory regime needs to be in place. Well, Bureau of Ocean Environmental Management is now producing and should be releasing in the next couple weeks a set of Arctic-specific regulations, draft set, which people should keep an eye on and take a look at when those come out, because that's the first time there will be regulations that are specific to drilling in the Arctic, not in temperate waters. And I say Arctic meaning offshore Arctic.
Yeah.
But it's really an important process, and we all have to, again, pay attention so that we can make sure that those regulations are not killed by people who don't want them.
Marilyn Hyman, I'm glad that you flagged that for all of us. I'm still thinking, however, when the lease sale took place in the Chukchi, they didn't know much about the Chukchi, to tell you the truth. And because there was billions of dollars put down for those leases, which then become kind of a property right, arguably, until they're bought back, that funded a whole lot of science. And that science then showed how sensitive that environment was. And nothing has happened to make it look less sensitive. It's just become more and more sensitive the closer we look at it, to the point where biologically, I think there's a very powerful argument that there shouldn't be any drilling anywhere around there, period. But because they already have the leases, BOEM can't do that now, can they?
Well, let's keep in mind that in the 1990s, Shell did drill in the Arctic Ocean.
They did, yeah,
and they,
four wells. Yeah.
The price of oil went down, and they did not continue in the Arctic Ocean. They're back, as you said. You know, there was a lease sale that they paid a lot of money for particular leases. But in if you look at that in context, in terms of Shell and all the decisions they're making around the world, and you know, billions of dollars is an awful lot to you and me, Steve, but it's not a lot to them. And they've spent a lot of money. They don't have a lot to show for it right now. It might be something that Shell decides to write off, because we have, as you pointed out, learned a lot about the sensitivity. We've learned a lot that from a mobilization standpoint, boy, it is incredibly difficult to move everything up to the Arctic safely that you need to. And, you know, it's a task that's almost beyond the ability of the captains of industry to do well.
Wow. Well, of course, and you're talking to a captain of an industry, of an entity that has got a little bit of a cash problem right now. So it's a great time to say that to him politically. As Talk of Alaska, yeah, hold it. We need to take a break here, Marilyn, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Subsistence is a significant part of the lives of many Alaskans. If it's important to you, consider applying for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The councils provide information and recommendations to the Federal Subsistence Board on subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing. The deadline to apply is Friday, March 21st. Call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov for more information. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Well, in answer to the question, what would it take to restore your trust, there's a bunch of email answers coming into that. I put that out in the promo to the program, and they're all saying, well, it would take, I don't believe I can trust them, period. And this is coming over and over again out of the emails. We have Marilyn Hyman of the Pew Charitable Trust, Lois Epstein of the Wilderness Society with us in the studio in a lively discussion of 25 years after Exxon Valdez. Marilyn, I interrupted you to get the break in. Go ahead.
Oh, well, I was just going to say another issue that is really relevant today is the increase in shipping that's going through both the Aleutians Islands and also the Bering Strait. That's a lot more shipping due to ice melting is predicted over the next several decades. And when you look at the Bering Sea, there's only one oil spill response organization for the entire coast of the Bering Sea. And as we get more vessels transiting, could be tankers, but it could also be other types of vessels that carry large amounts of fuel called non-tank vessels. And there need to be standards of care that are put in place, traffic lanes, areas to be avoided, vessel communication. There is kind of a vessel traffic monitoring system that should be in place. Many of these things don't exist right now because there hasn't been much shipping, at least through the Bering Straits. And we know that there are conflicts that are inherent in that increase in shipping, especially for subsistence hunting, people who, you know, the Siberian Yupiks and Yupiks who living along that coast and the Bering Sea and the Bering Strait go out and hunt marine mammals and subsist, and they're in small boats. They don't have any kind of satellite or AIS tracking. These large vessels coming through don't know those vessels are there. There are a lot of issues to be resolved, and a large spill in the Bering Straits could have horrible consequences for subsistence for, you know, both the Russian side and the U.S. side, and much work needs to be done there.
Yeah, and the, you know, there is some, you know, the industry itself is attempting to start clean itself up, at least in terms of the sea route that passes through the Aleutians, but I don't think anybody's given a whole lot of thought to the Bering Strait yet. But the regulators have. It's just that they haven't got too far with it so far. I mean, Mother Nature is moving faster than our planning processes, and how long would it take to actually get some kind of deep water port going around Teller? I mean, we got some construction years. We're some construction years out from any such project, and there's so much money involved, too. Big, big, big questions. Dave in Cordova has been patiently waiting. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Dave.
Good morning, Stephen, and to your guests. I've got to say, I'm shocked. I'm kind of flummoxed that Ms. Hyman is coming out as being an advocate for offshore drilling under, quote, safe conditions. There are no safe conditions up there. I've spent a lot of years up there in that ice, and that's a pipe dream. You're going to have a spill. There's going to be a huge mess, and it's going to affect the entire Arctic Ocean is the issue. Now, Pew is an offshoot of Sun Oil, so I guess I can understand the talking point, but I'll leave it there. Another thing that we're confronting here with virtually no control over is the possibility of the tankers coming out of the northern gateway tar sands route out of Alberta via Kitimat, B.C. Over 150 voyages, you can double that to 300, actually, because they'll be hauling condensate in to dilute the bitumen coming out of there. But it's going to pass within a couple miles of Cape Mizon in southeast Alaska, which is a horrid rock-strewn mess. And then at the same time, they will transit Unimak Pass on the Great Circle route over to China. And this is huge, and in conjunction with the projected liquid natural gas facilities in the vicinity, there's going to be incredible amounts of vessel traffic that is more than likely leading to some kind of a disaster there. And one final point, I was employed by the contractor on the spill barges out here in the Sound a number of years ago, and in the month I spent on there were critical pieces of equipment missing that never did get brought in or addressed, so essentially a 500-foot barge was worthless. So,
thanks for the voice of the Mariner out of Cordova, Dave.
Aye, aye. Thanks a lot for having the show. I'm looking forward to getting the podcast and spreading it around. So.
Spreading it around. All right. Thanks, Dave. Well, Marilyn Hyman, what's this Sun Oil in the Pew Trust?
It's true. The Sun Oil, the family that started Sun Oil is Pew Charitable Trust, or has created the Pew Charitable Trust. I feel very fortunate to work for Pew because, you know, they made their money on oil, but yet they have hired me, and we have a team of people working on getting, you know, the word out and trying to educate government and educate the public on why we need to be very, very cautious in both shipping in the Bering Strait and in, drilling in the Arctic Ocean. So it is true. That is where our money is, but they've been willing to invest in our work.
Yeah, and Pew, you're kind of running this part of the shop, and you would really like the citizen oversight, I sense.
Of course I would, and we have been very clear about what needs to be in place prior to any drilling. And as you said, Shell and Conoco and Statoil bid on those leases. They have a right to drill. There's nothing we can do short of just making sure they do it right, and then talk about what other areas potentially should be opened or should not be opened. And so I think it's one of those things that decision was made prior to my job even starting, that they let those leases. There's been a lot of review, legal and otherwise, of that, and there still will be discussions about that, but I think it's an important thing to know. They do have leases right now.
And that was a decision made by the Bush administration. It was something the Obama administration inherited. We're doing all we can to make sure that this administration does not let additional leases to the Chukchi go forward in 2016. We've learned a lot since the leases were issued in 2008. There's still some court challenges out there that are going on, but you know, there's no reason to actually open up new areas at this point to leasing in the Arctic Ocean.
Well, Lois, you would know this. Technically, they did get to go down a ways with a hole, so and then they plug it. But they can go back to that hole, right, and go ahead and penetrate to the horizon if they ever get
the
chance.
They can if they meet all the requirements. And they basically, we haven't talked much about the Kulik grounding at the end of 2012, the Shell drill rig, but it was unsalvageable. You had very harsh conditions, and they haven't been able to recover from that.
Yeah. Let's go to Pat joins the program from Ketchikan. Pat, thanks for hanging on for so long. Welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hello. Yes. I was on a small harbor tug during the oil spill. And Vico, I believe, was the name of the outfit, Vessel Dispatch, that
yes.
was running the show. And they would tell us to move from the harbor, get a barge, and go to what I believe was called the Weaver Dock. And invariably, that would be at low tide. The Weaver Dock is a tidal dock. If you're not there at high tide, you're not gonna make it.
So it was, move like you got a purpose, huh?
it was an absolute exercise in futility. And also, they had these fellows in Zodiacs going about the harbor with an oil boom strung between the two Zodiacs, and they would be in rain gear, and they would just cruise the harbor. Hour after hour after hour, just doing nothing but floating about in boats, which I thought was pretty good duty.
Yep.
I kind of was jealous of them on a sunny day.
Yeah.
And as far as their ability to actually make an effective cleanup, there was absolutely none. And they were out there with steam barges pumping hot water onto the beaches and then had booms strung out. And of course, the surface oil, the light hydrocarbons would indeed go into the water, but as the gentleman earlier mentioned, the rest of it was driven right down into the substrata of the beach, where it remains to this very day, leaching out.
Yeah.
As those vessels, the battleship in Honolulu Harbor is still burping oil. And I really doubt that these guys have any connection with trying to clean a spill up in the Arctic.
All right, Pat. Thank you. And we've run out of time, pretty much. Lois Epstein, you're with us here. You got a closing thought you can give us? 30 seconds.
A closing thought is that the state always has a role, and they've really let us down. They've been doing virtually no enforcement on spills, and the Coastal Zone program's gone, and that's all very unfortunate.
Marilyn Hyman, we never got to the 470 fund.
Oh, the 470 fund. Well, we need to make sure that they do continue to put money into that fund so that DEC can oversee both offshore and onshore oil and make sure that we don't have oil spills like the Exxon Valdez or the Deepwater Horizon or any other pipeline spills in our state. Very important.
Thanks so much for being with us. Thanks to Aaron Hennessy, KPLU. Next week, Lola, a ghost story. It's the Alaska Spirit of Reading. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Alaska Premier Dental Group, providing full-service dental care for the entire family with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Service information at smilealaska.com.
Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the trail. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.